that not to stand in my own way. And I think that that's for me and for every one of us. Like, we become our own obstacles. Like, we think we can't do a particular thing, or we think we're not ready for a particular thing, you know, like that negative thinking. And that's only coming from my head. Like, no one is really giving that to me.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of Artists Unscripted. I'm your host, Kenesha King, and today I speak with award-winning New Yorkerican author, Teresa Varela. Varela is a Brooklyn native storyteller and a psychiatric nurse practitioner at a New York City shelter for persons with mental illness. Varela has published 4 novels, and her poetry and short stories have been featured in several anthologies. Her storytelling is true to her Brooklyn environment, with characters having to thrive in grim realities of urban life. Here to discuss more about her journey as an author, here is author Teresa Varela.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
As an award-winning author with a PhD in nurse research and theory development, I have to ask, what came first, the storytelling or the nursing?
The nursing came first. I mean, the reading was always there since I was a baby. My mother read to me. Actually, I'm thinking of the dioramas. I used to make dioramas and always have little characters in them. So I was storytelling as I went into nursing. So there was illness in my family. And so I feel like I just went directly into nursing, that's the way it should have been. Eventually, I did go for my PhD, but I was on a track where I thought I wanted research, I wanted theory development, and that's what I followed, right? But when I was in, I went to NYU, that's where my doctoral program was. So when I was in there, I had to take a qualitative research course. And the instructor had us write playlets, she had us write poetry, all those wonderful things that I ended up loving. And she even said to me at some point during my doctoral process, she said, you know, she says, you're okay with the research, but you really shine with the storytelling. And I guess that stayed with me because I thought that I would continue that track. I had jobs that were on that track. And then eventually the storytelling took over, where I had some stories come to me and I had to write them out. And that's the only way I could put it, like the stories presented themselves. So it was nursing first, then it was the storytelling. Although I still am nursing, you know, as you had read that I am working in several shelters right now. So that's where I spend a lot of my time.
Both careers, they are vastly different. You have your creative side, and then you also have the nursing, which is more science-based. How do both careers complement each other? For, as you said, you did the storytelling within your research. How does that process go?
Let me go back. When I first started, I was a bedside nurse. You know, I worked with patients on a medical surgical unit. And then eventually I found that I was really unsatisfied and that I would bring my chair up to the clients and I would sit and talk to them. Like, I didn't worry. Not that I didn't worry, because I did make their beds, but that just wasn't happening for me. I wanted to know about the people. I wanted to know about their lives and more than just themselves with illness, which I could have done, but that wasn't enough for me at the time. And then I went into psychiatry, and I worked in community mental health for a long time. So I got to learn people. I got to meet them in their apartments, in their houses, and how lives were really going. I had such like a fruitful, I say, awakening of what's going on in the community. Eventually, when I did go up for my doctorate, what my study was, I decided to look at, because AIDS was very much big. I had worked bedside with people with AIDS. And then I worked mental health with people with AIDS. And then I noticed their spiritual paths. When you're working with people with AIDS before protease inhibitors, before all the medications came out, you had to deal a lot more with death and dying. I mean, you still do today, but certainly not like in the beginning. So I asked them about their spiritual lives. And then people that were practicing Orisha tradition, Yoruba tradition, they came to the forefront. Santeria. I was like, well, what is this? Like, what does this statue mean? What does that mean? And eventually I decided to do my doctoral study, you know, winding back to that, I decided to do my doctoral study on the meaning of, or the experiences of persons who are living with HIV AIDS who practice Santeria. So I did interviews with them. And at that point, Then I was invited to different events, different drummings, different ceremonies, and I started to open up. I really started to open up. And there's so much more than just nursing per se, because I'm a nurse practitioner and I prescribe mostly. I do evaluations for people's housing purposes, but I get to know the people. I get to know what's going on with them. Like what's behind you? Like, why are you in this shelter? Oh, it was a domestic violence thing. Oh, why are you in the shelter? I was, you know, trauma from age 3. So that these all help me to understand people, I guess. And that, although none of my books are about any one person that I've met in particular, it's more of a conglomeration of life and life issues within my storytelling. So that's how that all came together.
So you are a Brooklyn native and you lived there all of your life. What is about Brooklyn's urban environment that wants you to tell stories and characters based around the borough?
I love Brooklyn. It's so interesting. I mean, I was born there. My family was there. I've seen so many changes over the years. I grew up in Park Slope and, you know, people think Park Slope and I still have an apartment in Park Slope, actually. And people think, oh my goodness, you know, like that's such a gentrified, trendy neighborhood. And it wasn't like that when I grew up, you know, it was just us, regular people who were just like striving and a lot of, you know, Latinos and Blacks living in the area. And then suddenly the neighborhood changed. And I don't want to make this a, you know, an ethnic or racism type of talk, but that was my reality. And it was like my mother was dark skinned, right? I'm Puerto Rican. My mother was brown skin. And, you know, she had hard times finding apartments because of who she was. And, you know, based on where we got to live, people would look at us. So I knew this neighborhood as my home, as very nurturing. My father had a social club there where we played pool and, you know, we had domino games and stuff. And then when I became a teenager, we were routed to move out of the neighborhood. We went to move to Flatbush. My parents bought a house in Flatbush, which was really cool and everything, but it wasn't our neighborhood, you know? And finally we went back. I went back in my early 20s and I bought my apartment like years ago, but it's just so different there. But the stories, the lives, the people have continued. I have a cousin who lived in a storefront there on Fifth Avenue. A lot of my stories are on Fifth Avenue, which is one of the main areas, one of the main blocks. We went to eat at a restaurant a couple of years back and we're sitting in the restaurant and suddenly I look up and I say, Mike, this is your apartment. Like we realized that it had changed so much that we were sitting in his apartment. So, you know, like those are stories, you know, like we would, you know, take a little child's projector and play, you know, like we were actors and we were now sitting in this really trendy restaurant. So, I mean, but my heart is still there, you know, the schools, the people, I guess it's embedded within me. And I have to say, I know that this is BronxNet, right? So I want to say is that I was thinking earlier, many of my family members lived in the Bronx and that I first learned that I liked beans from the Bronx. My mother used to try to make me eat beans. I would never eat beans. And then my aunt made beans. And I loved her beans. So from then on, she said to me, oh, don't worry. These beans are from the Bronx. So I think that was my way to the Bronx. I mean, and I still do so many things there. So it's just, that's as important a neighborhood to me, not like Brooklyn, because Brooklyn is my home. But I just wanted to add that in because I thought it was just like, it came to my mind today. So I figured I needed to say this about the Bronx. I love the Bronx.
Speaking of dominoes, I started reading Covering the Sun with My Hand. And you did mention dominoes, like within the first few pages. And Covering the Sun with My Hand is your second book that you have released. And that's the relationship between siblings and mental illness, right? And it also holds a spiritual connection with it. And then you also, quote unquote, said that you were willed by the protagonist to write this story. Can you elaborate and give us some insight on this story?
I started it. It was, I called it like something like the neighborhood the eviction. I called it the eviction. I started writing this book about this apartment building on Fifth Avenue. And I had all these tenants in the apartments and all these relationships were growing. And then I didn't know where to go with it anymore. So I just put it in a drawer. And it was just like, I don't know, it was like putting all of this like background work into it. And then it wasn't going anywhere, or so I thought. And then one morning I woke up and one of the characters, Julia, who lived in an apartment 2R, she kind of basically talked to me. I woke up. It was one of those where you're kind of between dreams and you're awake. And she was like, this is my story. I want to tell my story. And suddenly the story took on another life about this young woman. The book is set in 1979, right? So you're in the 70s where there's the gentrification, but there's also the, you know, women's rights, women livers, right? It's like, you've come a long way, baby, that, you know, that old commercial with the cigarettes and all, you know, that craziness, like you didn't have to be who you were before. And so she was ready to go into college when her brother, who is her twin brother, he gets diagnosed with mental illness and her trajectory after that, like what happens to her? You know, because we always, I mean, we see stories like A Beautiful Mind. There was another one. I'm trying to think of the name of it. It was about a young Black man who was a violinist or a cellist, and he had schizophrenia. So you always get the stories from the schizophrenic or the person with mental illness's point of view. But the sister wanted to tell her story in this one. She said, this is me. This is what's going on with me. And her story came forth. So I felt like she willed me. And that happens with a lot of my stories, is that the characters come to me and they say, this is my story and this is what I want you to write. And then I just kind of sit there and type and listen to them talk.
I was going to ask, does that normally happen where you get word from the characters themselves? It's almost as if you will always stay connected that way, in a nice spiritual realm, and almost like you can relate because they're coming to you to tell their stories, right?
And in that particular book, it started out where she was moving out of her apartment. And so as she would open up each particular box, each drawer, things would come out and she would then have a memory of what happened. So that's how I started to write it, as a short story book. But when I went to publishers or, you know, editors, they were like, no, it needs to have a natural arc. And then I just changed the whole story around. So that book, I don't know, I went through it many times before it's in the iteration that it is in now, or that it has been. But, you know, Julia, that character still talks to me sometimes. And I have a whole set in my mind, which isn't on paper yet, of short stories from the other characters that are in that book that want to tell their stories. You know, like Anthony, the guy, he's just such a minor, minor character, but he lives upstairs and he's a pain in the neck. And she's always harassed by him. But like, what is his story, you know, with the mother who's very, his mother who's very religious, so that we get more of an understanding about the dynamics of everyone who's involved? Because it's not never just one story. There's just so much involvement there.
I love how you're so inquisitive to know more about people, to know about their stories. I'm the same way. I like to keep asking and knowing more so people really just uncover and unfold and unveil their actual truths, which is what a lot of your novels are based off, like truth seeking, where it has an enlightenment at the end of every story. What propels you to want to keep uncovering these truths? Because there's so many people in this world and there's so many stories, so much you can write about. What keeps you going and what motivates you?
This may sound totally out there, but I think it's my Scorpio rising. You know, like I'm like that scorpion, or not so much even a scorpion, but that fish under sea that just keeps going lower and lower into the depths. And it's hard. You get, oh, you too? I love it. That's why you're so inquisitive. I am. And I'm very spiritual. I have a very strong spiritual life. You know, I think that part of working with people with AIDS and the, you know, illness that was in my family, and just being with so many people who left this earth before we thought that they were supposed to, you know, I awoke to something different and it was underneath there. You know, it's that Neptunian area where you just go very, very deep.
I am an Aries, but I understand the Scorpio because I am a Scorpio rising as well. And okay. I also have done tarot, and I have like 15 tarot decks. And when I saw that you actually did an oracle deck as well, my heart was like, yes. Yes, she gets it. So
I too.
So not only that you incorporate your spiritualism in your novels, you've made your own oracle deck and you've made it with your daughter as well. Yeah. How did that come about? And did you or your daughter or both learn anything from this project together?
You know, that we're still we, but we're so in touch with spirit that, you know, spirit is there when at all times, you know, with the highs and the lows. And this oracle, I started probably, I think in 2003, actually, I started with the concepts were coming to me. I have a spirit guide I work with. This is like totally out there. Not for you, but for some people it might be. But this is who I am. So I have a spirit guide whose name is Graciela. And she kept talking to me about these images, these concepts. And I thought it was a tarot that I was initially creating, but it wasn't going anywhere. That was another thing that I had to put down. And I went to someone who reads for me. And she says, oh, no, that's not a tarot. That's an oracle. And when she said that, suddenly it was just like all shifted for me. And I knew that these were concept cards. I came up with the concepts, and I'm not an illustrator. I draw little baby images like stick figures and so forth. And my daughter, she had gone to FIT and I needed her help. And I liked her style. It's not because she was my daughter, but I liked her style. And I heard from Graciela that she was the one that I should work with. And so I would send her these little tiny pictures and the sayings with them. And then she would sit with the cards and eventually figured out what medium that she was going to use and develop these cards, which are quite colorful. They're quite lovely. I mean, even though I created them, I say that they're lovely because I feel like we were gifted with them. I feel like we were really gifted with them. Graciela, the spirit guide, her aim is to bring compassion and kindness to this world. So she wants to do that through me. Hence, the cards were made. I also had them translated into Spanish so that there's a little poetry type of snippet for each card that describes the card, but it's in English and it's in Spanish. So I also worked with a translator because my Spanish isn't that great. And he translated for me. Now, the best thing about this is that Graciela will work with you. So like if you get her cards, she will come to you in the cards, like truly an oracle. She worked with him when he was translating them to get the right words. And she worked with my daughter for the certain images that needed to be in the cards, because there were things in the cards that I didn't put here that she put here. So if I did a reading for you, it would be, I'd see something in the card even today, like years later, that I never even knew existed, because it's just so individualized to the persons. So they're very colorful. I mean, and I feel like there's still work to be done. I'm working on a book that really describes more about the concepts, because some people want to hear more. That's what the people who are buying the cards say to me. I want to hear more about it. I want more on spreads, like what spreads I can use. Like I don't use your typical Celtic spread. I have some other spreads that were channeled to me from Graciela. So I'm putting that all in a book. And I am hoping that I can get it done by 2022, which I should, because I'm just like at the tail end of it, but it's never done until it's done. I was compelled this time by Graciela to bring these cards and birth them into the world.
Oracle decks and tarot, that's a completely different type of storytelling. That is telling the truth. And you are right. It is individualized. You will forever find something new. Even if you saw the cards like 50 times a day, you will always pick up something new and individualized for each person. I love that. I need to buy it for myself. 3 out of your 4 books, we're going to shift back to the books now, have been International Latino Book Award winners, with, you know, your earliest book, as we talked about, Covering the Sun with My Hand. How does it feel as a storyteller to know that you have captivated your audiences for this amount of time and for almost every book that you have written?
In a way, it's a little hard to take in. I, you know, because I, like I said, I feel like I'm given these stories, you know, like I sit there and like Coney Island Siren, I was not happy that I was writing a book about domestic violence. You know, it starts out very beautiful. Like they're on the boardwalk. Yay, Coney Island. Yay. And then I find out it's like, do I really have to write this book? But, you know, again, my spiritual work tells me that I need to do this, that I need to be true to my art, you know, of writing. I still have to get used to that because it's still just me, you know, like the, I don't know, the book, it's like, you know, like you have a spiritual awakening and then you have to wash the dishes or do the laundry the next day. It's you know, it's that sort of thing. You know, it's like I'm writing, people like them, they're award-winning. And, you know, and I still have to make lunch, you know, I still have to make sure I have tuna fish in the you know, in the cabinets, like, it, you know what I mean? It keeps you kind of
contrast, the balance of both.
Yeah,
it's always a balance. Why do you think it's so difficult to speak about gritty realities and mental illness? For me, I've always been into stories, very gritty stories, very much, you know, harsh realities, expanding back to high school, maybe even before that, where I first read A Boy Named It, which was about child abuse. And it's very hard, and not many people can take that in. Why do you think it's so difficult to be able to tell these types of stories?
First inclination is to say it's a generational thing where we're taught not to talk about these things out in public. These are things stigmatized, mental illness, violence. Just keep them inside the house. Don't share them. But, you know, I didn't grow up like that. You know, like my mother, she, you know, it was, I guess, early 70s, right? And she bought me, you know, like Daddy Was a Number Runner or whatever it was. I don't know. And I loved that book. It was like real, you know, it was like, okay. For me, it's easier. For me, I sit across people every day who share their stories about like, these are the realities. But then we come out and we want to be like all wonderful, just kind of like social media, right? We're all wonderful. We're all beautiful. We all are like in love. And then, you know, again, balance, right? There's dark, there's light. And I, you know, and I think that my path is to bring these to the forefront. When I was working on my doctorate, I remember one of my goals was I wasn't so interested in writing for research journals because nobody really reads those except other researchers. So I remember like wanting to write stories where the regular person can read them and know what's going on or feel like that they can relate to what the topic, what the matter is. With the Coney Island Siren, I did a reading because there's a lot of poetry in this book that came through from one of the characters. And so I was reading the poetry at a reading up in the Bronx. And the server, she came from the back and she came to me and she said, oh my God, she says, you know my story. She was in tears. Okay, now if I had written that in a research journal about the, you know, this and this from this particular viewpoint, she would have never been able to cry and to meet a friend, you know, to meet someone who could share her heart with her for that particular moment. You know, it could give her some suggestions. Maybe you want to do this, maybe you want to do that. And that's really where my path has taken me. There are enough people that are doing that research route. There are enough people doing those other things. And this is what my HP wants me to do. You know, my higher power wants me to be with the people and to work with the people because I am of the people, which reminds me of like the whole domino thing. Like my father, he used to drive me to Flushing when I was very young, right? We used to drive to Flushing. There was a record store there. And if you saw people, you know, on the corners playing dominoes, he'd be like, you see those people? Those are your people. And I'd be like, okay, those are my people. You know, so I remember getting an award in the doctoral program and like saying that story, like it was so important to me because I'm just like everybody else. You know, I just like, it was fortunate that my mom just like drilled school into my head when I was younger.
What do you think is the biggest life lessons overall that you have learned along your whole journey, spiritual, writing novels, and in general in your practice as a psychiatric nurse? What do you think is the biggest life lessons?
The thing that came to mind was that not to stand in my own way. And I think that that's for me and for every one of us, like we become our own obstacles. Like we think we can't do a particular thing or we think we're not ready for a particular thing or that someone else can get something, but I can't get it. Why can they get it? But I can't get it. You know, like that negative thinking. And that's only coming from my head. Like no one is really giving that to me. You know, like I say, like, you know, as a child, like the way that I grew up, I mean, I was not in poverty. I definitely wasn't in poverty, but you know, it was week to week. We had food on the table. You know, my parents loved me. My older sister had, you know, was ill and she died when I was a child. So that was a really big change event that happened to our whole family. Like our whole family entirely changed. But then it was like not to hold myself back. And I can still do that. So yes, I would say that that is the, for right now, for this place and time, that's what I need to say. Like there are so many lessons, but that is this one for this place and time right now to say.
Do you have any advice for other storytellers as yourself that's also want to explore spiritualism, go into gritty storytelling, even mystery?
To write your story and not to compare, right? Because compare you despair. Don't ask for other people's approval. That is a big deal. Like I've learned that, and it, you know, it's, you know, I've been around the block quite a few times, you know, and I think that that's one of the main things is to know, like if I am spiritually aligned, I am going to get the advice that I need, you know, the suggestions that I need, my path is going to be cleared before me so that I'm going to meet people who are going to help me, right? It's just not me and HP. HP is going to put somebody in my path to help me and to be open to that. And to say, okay, that can happen, that I can have faith, that I too can have an abundant, prosperous life and not live in fear, and not live in fear that I can't, or that somebody is better than me, or that they have more than I do, or they know something that I don't know. That's just not the human experience. I mean, yeah, everybody has a different, you know, I'm not living in some huge mansion somewhere, but my HP provides for me. You know, my higher power provides for me. And that's where the spiritual foundation is that I know that I will never be dropped. Let's put it that way.
Do you have anything else you would like to share to your audience? Any events coming up?
I'm working with Threads now. I've worked with Threads for a really long time and then I put it aside. So I'm making book sleeves. I'm making pillows. I'm making, my spouse also, she is also making table runners and things because we want to have a business that is about Latino objects and heritage and art of good quality that we can share with the world. And I have it's called Latina Libations is our name. And I always say buy a gift for your book and you can put your book in a book sleeve, you know, which I didn't put it here with me right now, which I should have, but threads to me are like words, right? So that you put them together and you make a creation of something. I do needlepoint. I do cross stitching. You too, right? Oh my God. We have so much in common.
Definitely do needlepoint. Definitely picked it up from my grandmother. Yes.
Okay. And that's a story, right? You start out with a thread. You start out with a cloth and you create a story on canvas or on fabric. What is more beautiful than that? And that's like storytelling. And when I make something quick, it's a lot more, makes me feel better than, you know, taking a year to write a book, right? I can make something in a weekend, right? So I feel like I've accomplished something. So they're good together. So that's something that I'm working on. My spouse and I are working on right now is our Latina Libations site. And it's been a lot of fun. That and the cards and just continuing to write. I do workshops. Sometimes I do workshops on how to work with the cards. I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot, but, you know, a little here, a little there. And, you know, it's, you know, going with the seasons too. It's like, what is supposed to come to the forefront right now? And that's what I work with. I try not to fight against that, you know, too much or struggle against that process. I just let HP and nature tell me what I need to do next and try to listen.
Where can people follow you?
I have a website, two websites, which it will lead you to the same, which is teresavarela.com. Or latinalibations.com. Also, my Instagram is Teresa Varela Author or Latina Libations. And Facebook, of course, Teresa Varela. Twitter is also Teresa Varela. Teresa, lower line, Varela. I can be found at all of those places on social media.
Thank you, Teresa, for joining Artists Unscripted today. It was such a pleasure having you. And knowing about your journey in tarot and needle pointing. Thank you. You're definitely an inspiration and you are healing the world one by one for sure.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate talking to you today and getting to meet you and learning that we have so much in common. It's wonderful.
Artists Unscripted is a Bronxnet production hosted by Kenesha King, produced by executive producer Michael Maxnabi, produced by Jen Beagle, edited by Richard Diaz. Music is Wasted Education by Blue Topaz. Listen to this podcast and more on bronxnet.org/listen. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at BronxNet TV and on Facebook and YouTube at BronxNet Television.